Okay, so I can start this evening's Dhamma talk. It's on how to be at peace with sickness and death. I introduced the Dhamma talk yesterday by saying that one of the reasons why Buddhism is growing so fast in Western countries is because the teachings of the Buddha offer very powerful means of dealing with the ordinary problems of life. The philosophy of Buddhism, the attitudes of Buddhism, and especially the practices of Buddhism actually help people come to terms with such things as sickness and death, and that impresses other people who come across a sick Buddhist or a dying Buddhist or the relations of a dead Buddhist, and they see how wonderfully people cope with those experiences which for many other people cause a lot of suffering. It makes them interesting in the Buddhist philosophy and the Buddhist way of looking at things, because all people are seeking happiness in their life. And that happiness in Buddhism comes from understanding. And when that understanding is real and true, it actually helps to heal the problems of life. So Buddhism isn't just something you come and worship. Buddhism is something you come and practice, you come and understand. And if you really understand it, it will solve a lot of the difficulties and problems you face from day to day in life. In particular today, talking about the problems of sickness and death. Now I'm going to begin by asking you a question. Please put your hands up if you've never been sick in your life. Is there anyone here who's never been sick? People upstairs, please bang on the floor if you've never been sick. Okay, so I think it's very clear that everyone in this room and upstairs have been sick from time to time in their life. So it would be actually quite abnormal and strange if somebody put their hands up and they've never been sick. That would be really weird and strange and odd. It would be something wrong somewhere. So actually, it's natural to be sick. It's normal to be sick. It's right to be sick. So why is it when you go to the doctor, you say, "Doctor, there's something wrong with me. I'm sick." Now, if you were a Buddhist, and I hope you're going to do this, the next time you go to your doctor and you're sick, you should go to the doctor and say, "Doctor, there's something right with me. I'm sick again." Now, this is not just a joke, because one of the first reasons why people suffer so much with sickness is because they think it is wrong. They say it's wrong. And psychologically, they have the idea that sickness shouldn't happen. To the point that a lot of people exercise and they eat brown rice and they have health foods and they get very disappointed when they get sick. They've done all this hard work and they still get sick. Now the point is that no matter what you do, no matter how well you look after your health, still sickness will come from time to time. So first of all, there's nothing wrong with it. So when sickness comes, we should not feel guilty that we've done something wrong. I was talking yesterday about guilt and fear, and it's strange that how those two things are implicitly connected in something like sickness. When we become sick, we feel a little bit guilty and also a bit afraid as well. We're afraid because we're losing control of our body. Before, especially when we're young, fit and healthy, we can have full control of our body, we can tell it to do whatever we want to do, and it usually complies with our wishes. But when we are sick, we can't do hardly anything we want to do. And it is humiliating and very fearful to see that we're losing control of our body. So one of the things which sickness tells us is that who does this body belong to anyway? Who does your body belong to? Does it belong to you? If it did belong to you, you'd be able to tell it to be healthy. And well, sometimes you want to be sick when you want to take a day off work, maybe. But look, a lot of the times we get sick at the most inconvenient times. Some people get sick when Ajahn Brahm comes to Malaysia to give a talk and, oh, they missed his talks again. Sometimes we get sick when we're about to go on holiday, when we've got an important business meeting. Sickness comes when we least want it to happen. What it's telling us is that we've got no control over this thing called sickness. It's part of our body, but who's controlling this body? If the body really belonged to you, you'd be able to say, okay, it's convenient this week to be sick, but next week, please don't bother me. The point is, we can't do that. So we should know from the experience of sickness that this body does not belong to us, it belongs to nature. Nature is another word for Dhamma. It belongs to nature. It belongs to cause and effect. It belongs to karma, the environment, and all sorts of other things. I'm going to get enlightened in a minute. There's going to be a beautiful flash. There we go. So, the body belongs to nature. It doesn't belong to you. So this is actually, when we are sick, it's teaching us a very fundamental a very fundamental truth of Buddhism. We've all heard about anatta, non-self, haven't we? Well, that's one of the aspects of anatta, not mine. This body doesn't belong to me, therefore it's going to get sick when it wants to get sick, not when it's convenient to me. So when we realize it's not our fault and we've got nothing we can do about it when we're sick, then when there's nothing to do, one of my favorite sayings in Buddhism, when there's nothing to do, then we should do nothing. So we can rest and enjoy our sicknesses. Can you? It's great being sick. When I'm sick, I don't have to give any talks anymore. I can just lay in bed all day and get fed. In fact, when a monk is sick, it's really good fun. One of the reasons is you're giving other people a lot of opportunity to make merits when you're sick. Like, normally I don't need medicines. Normally I don't need vitamins. Normally I don't need being looked after because I'm quite fit and healthy. But when I'm sick, it's wonderful that you can all sort of nurse me and give me things. There was a monk in Chicago some years ago. He slipped over on the ground and broke his arm. Because Chicago is a very cold place. It's very icy and it snows in the wintertime. He was visiting his parents, walking somewhere along the street. He slipped down, he broke his arm, had to go to hospital. When his mother came into the hospital ward to see him, he told me his mother had the biggest smile on her face he'd ever seen. He wondered, what's wrong with my mother? Doesn't she know I'm in pain? I've broken my arm. Isn't she compassionate? And then she told him why she was smiling. At last she had her son exactly where she wanted him. Now she could mother him for weeks and weeks and weeks. And it's true, isn't it, that we like looking after the people we love and care for. It's actually good fun. It's an opportunity. It's actually to spread metta, practical metta. Not may all beings be happy and well, but let's go and do something about it. And so we really care, find out what they want, look after them, cheer them up, and all sorts of things like that. Which is what, it's a wonderful thing, a wonderful gift, if you're sick, to give other people the opportunity of developing their metta and compassion. So that's why it's a wonderful thing when you're sick. Secondly, that when you're, actually just on that, sort of on caring for the sick people, you have to be very careful when you go and visit people who are sick. Because most times, when you go and visit someone in hospital and they're sick, what do you say? You say, how are you today? What a stupid question that is. They're in hospital, they're sick. What do you expect them to say? And not only is it... Not only is it a stupid question to say, it really puts the person who's sick on the spot because they don't want to disturb, they don't want to upset you and spoil your day. So people who are sick, when they ask that question, how are you feeling today, they always tend to lie and break the fourth precept. They say, I'm feeling a bit better today, because they can't stand actually saying, I feel really awful today, and what do you ask that stupid question for? So because we're trying to be nice to the people who visit us, and when they ask us those silly questions, you know, we tend to exaggerate and not tell the whole truth. So please never ask a person who's in hospital, how are you feeling today? Instead, actually, you can, a wonderful thing when people in hospitals don't talk about their sickness, because they know what their sickness is. They're asked about their sickness from the doctors and the nurses all day. When you go and visit them, talk about something else. Because they're bored by the same old people coming in again and again. How are you feeling today? That's why that some years ago, I was visiting a Tibetan nun. She was an Australian. She lived in Perth. And even though I'm Theravada, she was Tibetan, even so that I'm very tolerant with the people who practice the other types of Buddhism. She stayed for a while practicing in our monastery, doing a little retreat. And when she got sick, I went to visit her. She got quite sick. She had cancer. So when it got really bad and she got moved into the hospice, I used to visit her from time to time. And this one occasion that she rang me at my monastery and said, look, can you come and visit me? I really think I'm going to die in the next couple of days, because the cancer was really far advanced now. And it's a strange thing, she was absolutely right. In 2 days she did die. You know, people when they get close to death, they can actually pretty much know how many more days they've got left. And anyway, so I went to visit her. I went to the hospice in Perth. And of course, the first thing you have to do is to check in at the reception. And when I told them who I was and who I was going to visit, the nurse at the reception said, I'm sorry, but she's given explicit instructions that no one's to visit her. And I said, look, that can't be the case, because she just rang me an hour ago and asked me to visit, and I dropped everything to come and see her. And the nurse said, look, she told me, absolutely, the whole of today, no visitors. And I stood my ground. I said, look, well, why did she call me? And then she said, come here. And she took me to her room, the door and her room. You see, what does that say? It said, absolutely no visitors. And then I told her, what does it say on the bottom? And in very small print was, except Ajahn Brahm. So she let me in. And I asked this Tibetan man, I said, why did you put that down there? Absolutely no visitors except Ajahn Brahm. Why me? And she said that everyone else who comes to visit her, she's close to death, they get so upset that she's about to die, and they start crying, and they make her feel so miserable. And I'm the only one who goes in there, cheers her up, tells her jokes. And she said, look, I know I'm going to die. I don't want miserable people to come and make this worse. I want sort of people who are at ease with life and death, who are eased with sickness, not people who are worried about it. I want someone to put me at peace, not want someone to make me more worried. And that's why she let me in. I've got a very good bedside manner when I go visit people. Because when you are sick, what would you want when you are sick? Would you want someone to say, oh, you poor thing, please don't die, please get better soon. You can't leave me and the children. You've got to get well and go to work, because we haven't paid off our debts yet. Now, instead of disappointing, you want to cheer someone up who's sick. Because one of the great ways of overcoming sickness is the right attitude, a little bit of happiness. It does wonders for healing sickness. And when I went to the talked to some students this afternoon, they were telling me that they really loved that video of Patch Adams. Have you seen that video? I've never seen it, but I've heard about it. Just a doctor who made people laugh and basically cheered them up and made them a little bit healthier. And it's well known in science that if you laugh, if you smile even, then I think it's endorphins are released into the bloodstream. They're nature's painkillers. Not only is it make you feel happy, it also helps with your immune system and clearing up the illness. I found that out in my first year as a monk in Thailand. Whenever we used to go on to any ceremonies in different monasteries, we used to go in the back of a pickup truck. The head monk would sit in the front seat. He was fine, but we small baby monks had to go in the back. And these pickup trucks, they're just like a tray in the back, they were covered with a metal frame over which was stretched canvas. So in case it rained, you wouldn't get wet. Now the trouble was, the roads in that part of Thailand were all gravel roads. Whenever it did rain, they would be full of potholes. And so when the truck hit a pothole, the truck went down and the monks went up. And I was much taller than the Thai monks, and also monks have got no head protection, they're bald. So when you crack your head against these metal railings, it really hurt. Now, I'd only just been ordained, I was still a young monk, so I must admit this, when I hit my head and it really hurt, I swore. That's just now what you, that's my habit. Because in the Western world, if you hurt or slip over, you know, you curse. Now, in this particular time, I saw some of the Thai monks also hit their head. And when they hit their head, they laughed. And I thought they were absolutely crazy. How can you laugh when it hurts so bad? But again, my training was in science. So I decided to do an experiment. I decided the next time I hit my head, instead of cursing, I try laughing. You know what I discovered? I discovered if you hit your head and laugh, it hurts much less. It's true. Try it. No, it was actually true, because just laughing got rid of the pain. Endorphins were put in the body, nature's painkillers, you didn't hurt so much, and also you didn't bruise so much either. That degree of laughter is not only nature's painkiller, but one of the great medicines for times of sickness. So that's why if you do visit someone in hospital, take some jokes, take some laughter there. Take one of Ajahn Brahm's tapes there to cheer them up, make them laugh. And it's a great way of helping them to get better. Because when we get so serious, afraid, upset at sickness, it's liable to last a much longer time. We want people to be healthy, if it's at all possible. So one of the ways of dealing with sickness is not just to be equanimous with it, but actually enjoy it, have fun with your sickness. Laugh at it. And that's happened many times in when I've seen monks who've been sick. For example, one of the first sicknesses I had was typhus fever. With all the monks in Wat Nana Chat in Thailand got this typhus fever. It's caused by a little mite which lives in the forest floor. Only the Westerners get this because all the local Thais, through generations of living in that area, they've all got natural immunity. So that one of the first experiences when I was in hospital in Thailand, this was a very remote area of Thailand at the time. The local hospital was very much a third world country hospital. And for example, that they were putting all sorts of antibiotics in me with injections. And the needles they used, they weren't these just use once and throw them away. These would be the ones they'd already used in Bangkok, and then they sent them up to the northeast to be used on the other patients first of all. And because monks were tough, then they last were used on us monks. And so they had to really stab you to get it through the skin. It really hurt. Not only that, but I was really feeling upset, because one of the experiences I had was the first night I had this terrible fever and I felt really sick. I didn't know what was going on. And at 6 o'clock, the nurse went off duty. And then about after half an hour, no other nurse had come, so I asked the monk in the next bed, "Where's the night nurse?" He said, "There is no night nurse. If you happen to get ill and sick at night, that's just bad karma." So that didn't really sort of make me feel all that good, but what really cheered me up one day And I've been in the hospital about 3 or 4 days, and I felt really miserable because of all the injections with these really blunt needles. My bottom was very, very sore, and I felt very, very sick and awful and terrible. And who came in to visit me but Ajahn Chah? And immediately I got so uplifted. I felt so wonderful that the great teacher had come to visit me. But my joy and uplift only lasted for a few seconds. Because then when Ajahn Chah opened his mouth, all he said to me was Brahma Wangso, you'll either get better or you'll die. And then he left. That's brilliant teaching, wasn't it? Brilliant Dhamma. You can't fault Ajahn Chah. You know, he just goes right to the point of it. He said, but you don't have to worry, you won't suffer all that much longer. Either it will get better or you'll die. Which is the other thing about sickness, that we know that sickness will never last. So no matter how sick you are, you can always endure because you're either going to get better or you're going to die. When a Buddhist is sick, this is what they should do. They should actually contemplate that sickness, to use it for the growth of wisdom and understanding. I went to stay with a great teacher in Thailand, Ajahn Mahabua. And when I was there, I only stayed about 7 days, and he gave a talk, especially for me. And I understood, even though it was a translation in Thai afterwards, I understood the Thai so well, I didn't need a translation. He told a story when he was a young baby monk with Ajahn Mun. And when he got malaria fever, he decided to fight it and not give in. Now this monk, Ajahn Mun, is a very tough monk. He's got enormous willpower. And so he was using that willpower to fight the sickness, to try and conquer it. And he was doing quite a good job. Now, Ajahn Mun saw this and called a meeting. And he literally scolded this young monk, Mahabua, later to be a great teacher, saying that's not the way that a Buddhist should face sickness. Don't fight it. Contemplate it. Understand it. Because sickness is one of your great teachers. It's teaching you that your body does not belong to you. It's teaching you that that sickness is just the space between two healthy moments. It's teaching you so much Dhamma. Why waste the opportunity and fight it and try and run away from it? Sickness should be faced up to and contemplated. Because when we contemplate sickness, we should be able to find one important truth. And that important truth is encapsulated in the teaching of the Buddha in the Dhammapada. Even though the body is sick, the mind does not need to be sick. The mind can be healthy. What he was pointing to there is there's two types of sickness, two types of pain. The bodily pain and the mental pain. And I mentioned yesterday in the talk, I think I did mention about the member of our monastery who pulls out his own teeth. I mentioned that. That's a very good example of the difference between mental pain and physical pain. It's the mental pain which thinks, oh, that's terrible, I can't do that. The physical pain is only 2 seconds, nothing at all. However, if we add mental pain to physical pain, we just cannot endure this. It's just too much. It's the same with sickness. It's the physical pain is what we can't really do anything about. But the mental pain, we can do something about. We can let go, contemplate, and even learn from that sickness. The Buddha gave a story in the Udana, which is one of my favorite stories. It can be applied to many things, but especially to most sicknesses, which I said yesterday were stress-caused. It's a simile of the demon in the emperor's palace. It goes like this. There was an emperor who lived in a wonderful palace, and he was away on business somewhere. when he was away, a demon, a very ugly, offensive, fearsome monster, walked into that palace. The guards, the ministers, and all the people who worked in that palace were so shocked at the sight of this monster, this demon, that they froze, and that was long enough for the demon to go right into the emperor's chair, the throne, and sit down. As soon as that emperor, that demon, sat down in the emperor's chair, the soldiers, the ministers, the guards, the courtiers, they started coming to their senses. They got angry and they said, "Get out of there. You don't belong in there. Who do you think you are in sitting in our emperor's chair?" At every unkind word, unkind deed, or even unkind thought, that demon grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and more offensive. And that made all the soldiers even more upset. They got their swords out, they flashed their swords. "If you don't get out of here quickly, you'll be in big trouble. Get out! Who do you think you are?" At every unkind word, unkind deed, unkind thought, the demon just grew an inch bigger, more smelly, more ugly, and more offensive. Now this had been going on for a long time when the emperor came back. And by this time, this demon was huge, taking up half of the throne room. And he was so ugly and frightening, I don't think even Steven Spielberg could imagine something as ugly as that. And the smell would just make you reel. It was just so awful. And the language was worse than you'd hear in a pub in the worst streets of Perth on a Saturday night. It was terrible. But the emperor was the emperor for one reason, that he was the wisest of all the people in that realm. And when he saw the demon in his chair, he knew straight away what to do. He said, "Welcome. Thank you for coming to visit me, demon. It's been such a long time. Has anyone offered you something to drink yet?" And they offered this demon four drinks, one hot one. And it's just that kind word, those kind deeds and that kind thought, the demon grew an inch smaller. Less smelly, less ugly, less offensive. And when the people in the palace saw that, they realized their mistake. So they went around being kind to the demon, asking what he needed. "Exactly what type of tea do you want? Do you want herbal tea or do you want English tea? We've got Earl Grey, we've got English breakfast, we've got Darjeeling. Do you want sugar or honey? What do you want to eat? Do you want sandwiches? How about some noodles? We've got some noodles straight from KL this evening, from the best shop. How about some Malaysian coffee?" Somebody gave him a foot massage. Somebody massaged his back, because demons get very sort of sore back sometimes. And they were so kind to this demon that every kind deed, word or thought, the demon grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less offensive, less smelly. And it seemed in no time at all the demon was reduced to the size when he originally came in. But they didn't stop there. They carried on with the kindness until the demon was so small that one more act of kindness and the demon vanished completely away. And that's how they got rid of the demon who entered the emperor's palace. Now that story was told by the Buddha in the Udana. He said, "Monks, that is called an anger-eating demon. It eats anger, and every bit of anger which you give it to eat, it grows an inch bigger, more ugly, more offensive, in every which way. Many sicknesses are anger-eating demons. Get out of here. You don't belong. I don't want to be sick. Get out of here." These sicknesses, which are stress-produced, will not respond if you give them more stress. That's why one wonderful way to deal with sickness is, "I'm sick. Make me sicker." Now try that. What it's going to mean is that when you relax with that sickness, when you accept that sickness, when you're at peace with that sickness, when you investigate that sickness rather than trying to fight it, you find very often that sickness starts to disappear. It's an anger-eating demon. You know, one of those sicknesses which fill that category of anger-eating demons today is cancer. We hate cancer. We're afraid of cancers. That's why when one comes in our body, get out of here, you don't belong. How about trying to be at peace with your cancer? If you really could do that, I mean really do that, you'd find it would disappear. Make it vanish completely away. I tried that once, not with cancer. In my first year as a monk in this remote monastery, I had a very bad toothache. It's my toothache story. There was no medicines. There wasn't even a pair of pliers in the monastery to pull it out. And there was no telephone, there was no doctors or dentists within a long way of this monastery. And like most aches and pains, they tended to get worse at night time. I don't know why that is, but that seems to be the psychology, that they get worse when you're alone at night, in your hut or in your bed, and you can't do anything. So I had a strong mind. I could meditate very well. But in with that toothache, it got so bad that I couldn't watch my breath. I couldn't sit down and meditate. I just had to get up. I tried doing some walking meditation. But as I was walking backwards and forwards outside, I found I had to stop walking meditation because I was running meditation. This is what happens when you're desperate, you can't do anything slow. When you're in great pain, you know, you have to run around. You're frantic, you're desperate. So I decided to go back into my hut and try doing some chanting. Now, I'd only been recently ordained as a monk, and to be honest, I didn't believe in all this chanting business, this hocus-pocus, it's just superstition. I just went along with it because all the other monks did, but I didn't believe in it, really. But I gave it a try. I had to stop the chanting, because I was shouting at the top of my voice to chant. And because it hurt so much, I couldn't do anything slow or softly. And when I finished stopped the chanting, I remember this occasion in my hut. It was roughly about midnight. In this forest, in this jungle, with all the other monks were fast asleep. I didn't want to wake them. And I was so desperate, I didn't know what to do next. I couldn't stand the pain any longer. And I didn't have any way to escape from it. Usually, when your back is against the wall, that's when you remember the Dhamma you've been taught. And the word which came to my mind, which I'd heard many times before from Ajahn Chah, which I've read in the books, I've heard from so many teachers, was a very simple word called let go. You've all heard that word before. Have you ever done it? That was the first time I let go. And it was an amazing experience for me, because as soon as I let go, that just word came into my mind and I followed its meaning. The pain immediately disappeared. It was a incredible experience. And it was replaced by just so much bliss, so much peace. 1 minute ago, I was desperate, in agony. The next moment, there was no pain at all. I realized from that point how much of pain is added onto by the mind. I was fighting that pain, trying to get rid of it, trying to find a place where that pain wasn't, where I could be. Because of that fighting, I was making that pain worse and worse and worse. It was an anger-eating demon, and I've been feeding it. Now I let go. The demon vanished. I meditated for about an hour in the middle of the night, just so peacefully, so beautifully, no pain at all. Then about 1 o'clock, I lay down to sleep, only just for a couple of hours. When I woke up with the bell at 3 o'clock, that's when they rang the bell in Thailand, you had to get up at 3 o'clock. Actually, it was optional. You could always get up earlier than three. When I got up at 3 o'clock, my mouth ached, the pain was there, but it was nowhere near as great as it was the night before. But from that time on, I wasn't afraid of pain. I realized what pain really is. Pain is, I don't want you to be in here. Get out. Whatever pain you experience in life, and there will become times when you're in great pain, and whatever medicine you get from your doctors, or maybe you can't get it in time, please remember those words. Just let go. Maybe, like myself, you'll be lucky enough to actually understand its meaning and actually do that letting go. And you'll find all the pain will disappear. There was a fellow many years ago who was working in Western Australia in the mines. He would go at night time, he was always on night shift, by himself to plant the explosives. He was an explosives man. He'd go down into the mine, put the explosives, set them off, blast them, and in the morning the other workers would come, chip away the ore and put it in the trucks to take back to the surface. It was such a dangerous job, he'd do it by himself, at night when no one else was working. He said he had a premonition that something would happen that night, but nevertheless he went to work, he checked the explosives, everything was okay, there should be no danger at all. But just after putting the explosives in, he hadn't put the detonators in yet, he heard a sound behind him. It was one of the rail cars. Someone had left a brake off, and it was rolling down the incline towards him. And he said that his work of blasting was so good, there was no place to jump, to escape. The truck was coming towards him, it would hit him, and there was no way of avoiding it. So when it hit him, he tried to jump. It hit him, he fell to the ground on the tracks, and then he felt to see that there was no leg. It had severed his leg off. And he lay there, and it was the middle of the night, it would be another few hours before the first shift would find him. As he lay there, he said it was the most wonderful feeling in his life. He had what is called the religious experiences. He let go because it hurt so much. And when they found him, they took him to the hospital, they patched his leg up, he survived. He said that one of the workers came to see him. He was the one who left the brake off. And he said when he saw the worker sort of hovering around the doorway, afraid to come in because he felt so guilty, he called the worker over to him, "Come, it's okay, there's no problem at all. I want to thank you for giving me that wonderful experience." That just so confused the man, he never came in, he just ran away. It was the wrong thing to say, but he thanked that man for giving him an experience which was worth a leg. The experience of letting go. Now, that's sometimes how we can deal with sickness. We can let go. If there's something we can do, to take some medicines or to do some exercises or whatever, you can do that. But be at peace with that sickness and contemplate it. Realize if it gets better, that's marvelous. If it leads to death, that's okay also. It's all right to die. Because part of the sickness, part of the fear of sickness, is because we're afraid that that sickness might lead to our own death. And we're afraid of that. At least most people are. Buddhists shouldn't be. In fact, most Buddhists aren't afraid of death. One of she's not a devotee anymore because she died some years ago. She, one of the devotees at the time, she, you know, Ratana, you remember her song, she developed lung cancer. There's always something wrong with her, but she went in for a checkup and they found it was lung cancer, very bad, and basically there was nothing much they could do for her. So she rang me at the monastery and I went to visit her, and when she was lying in her bed there, she was quite happy. She was laughing and joking with me. You know, she'd very quickly come to terms with the fact that she wouldn't live for more than 2 or 3 more months. She had 4 children, sort of no husband. She separated from her husband a long time ago. 4 very good children. And she was quite confident that she brought them up well enough to look after each other. And they did. They're marvelous kids. She wasn't at all afraid of death. In fact, she was joking with me. She said, "All the other Thai people, don't tell them to come and visit me now. Tell them they can come and visit me later when I'm in my coffin. I won't mind then. And she laughed. But when I walked out of the ward, the sister, the head of the ward, said, come over here, please. I want to talk to you in private. And this was this Irish Catholic nurse. And when she's talking to me, she said, I'm so glad you've come, she said to me. I'm so glad you've come. So that Thai girl there, she's in denial. I said, what do you mean she's in denial? She said, she's not accepting the fact she's going to die. I said, look, she's been telling me she's going to die. She's made all her plans. She's been talking about her funeral. And then the nurse looked very confused. Why isn't she angry then? Why isn't she upset? Because that nurse, working in the cancer ward, just about every time she saw someone who'd been told they're going to die, they got angry, upset, cried, complained. But that girl didn't. There was no fear. She accepted straight away. And she died a very beautiful death, a very inspiring death. Her doctor, who wasn't a Buddhist, said she died with class, he said. That's Australia. And that actually showed the possibilities of like dealing with death. Just like sickness, there's nothing wrong with dying. It's not against the law. It's not against the precepts. It's all right to die. So don't be afraid of it, especially if you've done lots of charity, you keep precepts, you've come to the temples, you've done a lot of support. But if you've done all that, you're going to have a wonderful rebirth. So why are you afraid of dying for? As a monk, I have to teach funerals. I have to sort of take funerals. One of the stories I tell at funerals is this. It's the story of the couple, the married couple, who died within days of each other. I told this in Penang. This couple, like many married couples, they'd been married for so long, when one died, the other one died within a couple of days. You've seen that before? It's just, they're so close together, when one sort of dies, the other one just can't basically live without them, and they die of grief or whatever. So the two of them died within days of each other, so they appeared in heaven together. And they were met by an angel. An angel took them to this beautiful mansion overlooking the cliffs. And they said, because of your good karma, this mansion is yours. Now, in this life, that would be a multi-million dollar mansion. And you'd have to be sort of either a gangster or something to actually afford such a thing. And the man said, I think it's the same in Malaysia as in the other country. The more expensive your house, the more you have to pay land taxes. So this man said, that's an expensive house. I don't think I can afford the taxes. And the angel said, look, this is heaven. You don't have to pay taxes up here. It's free. And so they took him inside. And there were so many rooms in this mansion. And they were all had just wonderful furniture. Some furniture was from Europe. There was some beautiful furniture from Australia. And even wonderful Malaysian furniture was in there as well. And they had DVDs and full-screen videos. And goodness, they had everything there. You could... some really expensive stuff as well. And when he was led through all these rooms, the angel gave a little card. See, this is my email. If you want anything changed, email me and I'll fix it straight away. If there's any furniture you don't like. And so the man said, look, this is some expensive furniture. I don't think I can afford the insurance premiums. And the angel said, look, this is heaven. We don't allow thieves up here. There are no insurance premiums to pay. This is for free. And look, anything you don't like, just let me know and I'll change it immediately. And then he took him down to a triple garage. In that garage, there was a new four-wheel drive. A huge monster of a vehicle. Next to which was a Rolls-Royce stretch limousine. And then next to that was a red Ferrari sports car just a special issue. There's only about 30 of them in the whole of heaven. And he said that these are yours to drive around. If there's anything you don't like, remember my email, I'll change the model straight away. And the angel said, just to let him know, look, there's no policeman up in heaven, so you can speed as much as you like. He'd always wanted a sports car, but of course in this world he could never afford it. And if he did afford it, he could never really enjoy it because all the policemen were on the roads. So, he said, they're wonderful cars, especially that red Ferrari, but look, when you have expensive cars like this, you have to pay license fees for the government. And basically, I've got no money, I can't afford this. And the angel said, there are no license fees up in heaven, this is all for free. Even the petrol is free. And he opened the gates of the doors of the garage, and the opposite side of the road was this beautiful 18-hole golf course. And he really liked his golf, because Malaysians like golf as well, don't they? He really loved his golf, and the angel said, see that golf course on the other side of the road? That was designed by Greg Norman. And that country house, country club over there, that's one of the best country clubs I'll arrange. You don't have to queue up. You don't have to wait to tee off, and there'll be a caddy waiting for you at any time of the day. And even because it's heaven, we'll throw in a few holes in one at every round, just to make you happy. And he looked at that clubhouse, and it was just so immaculate and so fancy. He said, look, I don't think I can afford the club fees. And the angel said, look, there are no club fees, there's no license fees, there's no insurance, nothing to pay up here. This is heaven, this is your reward for all the good karma, you know, for making all those donations to the BGF. And so the angel left them with a beautiful mansion, sports cars, golf club across the road. And as soon as the angel left them, this man started getting really angry at his wife. He started scolding her and getting really upset. And his wife just couldn't understand. He said, look, why are you getting angry at me for? You've got this wonderful house, this beautiful furniture, and you've got your red sports car. I know you always wanted one. And you've got your golf course on the other side of the road. You can play any time you want. Why are you so angry at me? And the man looked at his wife and said, wife, if it wasn't for all your health food, I could have been up here years ago. So why are you feeding your husband all this health food? Now, the moral of that story is that why are good people afraid to die when they've got mansions and Ferrari sports cars and golf cars? Maybe heaven might not be exactly like that, but certainly we know we should have confidence and faith. No matter what religion you are, all the religions say if you're a good person, you're going to have a wonderful rebirth. So why are we afraid to die? Why are we afraid when other people die, especially when they are old and they've had enough of this body? Why can't we just let them go? A lot of the times it is because we don't understand death, we're afraid of death, and we don't look upon it in a proper way. But death is just the ending of one life. As a Buddhist, we know we're going to have another life afterwards, if not in heaven, back on earth or somewhere else. So never think you've finished with school. You're going to have to go back there again next time. And do more exams. Unless you become fully enlightened and have an end of all this schooling and nappies and growing up and all that sort of stuff. But when we understand what rebirth is, it takes away the fear of death. Especially if we've been a good person. I tell people that, actually I tell that joke at funeral services. The first time I told that joke, I saw they have these funeral directors. These are the people who actually organize the funerals and do all the arrangements. And they wear, you know, they're ones who carry the coffin in, they wear black suits, and they look very sort of formal and serious. And when I was up there sort of giving this talk or this joke, he was standing at the back, he was frowning at me. He said, don't do that, don't do that. because you're not supposed to tell a joke at a funeral. Do they tell jokes at Chinese funeral services? The point was that everybody laughed when I told that joke. And when they laughed, the funeral director at the back was a big sigh of relief. And afterwards, they all came up to me and said, "Thank you so much. Thank you for telling that joke, because that's what he would have wanted. He didn't want people to be upset and cry at his funeral. Do you want people to be upset and suffer and cry at your funeral, or would you like them to be happy? If you want them to be happy, you can invite me to give your funeral service." But it's not just levity, because it's making a point not to be afraid to die. They also tell another story of the funeral service, which is a more serious one, but a very beautiful story as well, which is why I tell it very often. And you know, it comes from my heart, because it comes from my own life when I was a young man. My father died when I was 16. And I loved that man very much. He was a very good father to me. But when he died, at his cremation, I never cried. I never felt sad. My eyes never went watery. And I haven't cried since. I felt no grief. And it took me a long time to explain what I felt, as much to myself, if not to other people. And I've incorporated this story into just about every funeral service which I conduct. This is how I explained how I felt to myself. Again, I use similes. When I was a young man, growing up in London, I loved music. I used to go to many concerts in London, and there were some of them classical music concerts, sometimes rock concerts, folk, jazz. I used to like every type of music. And I used to sometimes see, like, people would later on become famous. There's even some of these rock bands. You know, I saw the first concert of Led Zeppelin, just in a small club. I remember seeing Rod Stewart in a top floor of a pub with about only five or six other people who came that evening to see this band. All these people later on became world famous. But at that time, they were just, you know, small-time bands. And I loved them. I used to go to the Royal Albert Hall to listen to concerts. And I remember vividly, even as I talk to you now, I remember so clearly. When the concert was over, I would stand up and clap for more, shout for more. So would a lot of other people as well, because I loved my music. And the band would very often would play on a little bit longer. The orchestra would just play maybe another 10 minutes. But then eventually the orchestra had to go home. They had to pack away their instruments and go back to their own families. It was late at night. And as I walked out of those concert halls of London, it was always drizzling, cold, dark and gloomy outside. But even though I knew that I would never hear that performer again, I never once felt sad. What I felt when I went out into that cold London night was what a wonderful performance that had been, and how lucky I was to have been there at the time. How fortunate to have heard such great music played by such a great orchestra. And I carried that music in my mind all the way home on the underground train. And even the next day, I was inspired and uplifted by great performances. And I realized that was precisely the feeling I had in my heart when my own father died. When I went out of that crematorium into the cold, gloomy London afternoon, I felt what a wonderful performance that was, Father, and how lucky I was to have known you and to have been with you for 16 years. Thank you. And I always remembered his examples and his teachings to me. I never felt sad. I felt grateful. I felt uplifted. I felt inspired by a wonderful life. I would have wanted it to go on longer. It would have been great if he could have seen me as a monk. He would have been so proud. But I was just grateful for those 16 years I knew a man like that. He was the one who told me when I was a couple of years earlier. He took me aside and he told me, he said, "Son, whatever you do in your life, whatever you do, the door of my house will always be open to you." I always remember those words. Again, it took me a while to really understand fully what they meant, because his house was a small apartment in London. It wasn't a much of a house to open to anybody. But what he really meant was, "Son, whatever you do in your life, the door of my heart will always be open to you. You'll always be my son. I will always love you. I might argue with you, I might not agree with you, but please know, I will always love you." That was the first understanding I ever had of unconditional love, whatever I did. And that's the sort of man he was. So when he died, I felt so inspired that I knew such a wonderful man. I've told that story many times at funeral services. And I've changed people's grief into inspiration. People thought they were going to cry, and instead they started looking at how grateful, how lucky they were to have known a person who's now passed away for so many years. And they say, "Thank you, wife. Thank you, husband. Thank you, father. Mother, what wonderful music that was. What a wonderful life we shared for those few years. Thank you so much." And they go out of that funeral celebrating a life rather than mourning a death. That's the Buddhist attitude to life and death. So enough of all these tears. How about some inspiration when our loved ones pass away? A sense of gratitude. "Thank you for being my father, my mother, my friend for so many years." That attitude is noble. That attitude is wise. That attitude puts a completely different complexion on life and death. It accepts death as inevitable, as part of life. It brings it in and it deals with it in a wonderful way. It's being at peace with death. Being at peace with death is not that hard a thing to do. When I performed those funerals, some of the first times I did this funeral, I remember one funeral I did for this English man. He was only about 21 when he died of cancer. And his parents came all the way over from England to actually, obviously, to come to his funeral service. They knew he was a Buddhist, but they knew nothing about Buddhism. And I remember very clearly that because he was a Buddhist, he wanted a Buddhist funeral, and I was the one who was conducting that funeral for him. And these were two English, an English man and an English woman from a village in the southwest of England, very conservative. And when they saw me come in to conduct the funeral service for their son, I saw their faces drop. I knew what they were thinking. "Oh my God, who is this doing a funeral service for our boy? He was my only son. What is this? Can't we have a vicar or a priest or something to do a proper service, please?" But when I finished that funeral service, they were so impressed, they wrote out a check for $500 on the spot. And they came and visited about 5 years later. They say,
to our monasteries. They went back to England, they came back and said, we can't get you out of our mind. That was such a wonderful funeral service that meant so much to us. We were so upset at losing our son, only 21 years of age, to cancer. He said, you turned all our sorrow around and made us feel at peace with our son's death. Thank you. They came all the way over to England 5 years later, especially to see me. No other thing. And I was very touched by that. I've been very touched by many other funeral services I've done for Buddhists. When the relations who are Christians come up to me afterwards and say, look, I'm a Christian, but when I die, will you do my funeral for me as well? Because this is coming to terms, you know, with death. There's nothing wrong with death. So please bring death into your life as part of life and be at peace with it. A lot of times when you're at peace with death and dying, you live much longer. This is another story I like to tell of this monk. He was a Rhodes Scholar. He was a wrestling champion in the United States, but also very intelligent, and won a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford, and later he became a monk. But while in Thailand as a monk, he developed an illness. Unfortunately, we had a doctor visiting our monastery, because he diagnosed it as typhoid, and he saw he was that sick, he told us, get that monk to Bangkok immediately.